Welcome to WRTI's Classical Stream, made possible by contributions from listeners like you. Learn more at WRTI.org.
This particular program will be filled with explanations of wonderful, wonderful works that are being sung by the Anonymous Four. I'd like to welcome Susan Hellauer, member of the wonderful group Anonymous Four. Welcome to Crossover, Susan.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You are actually part of a group that caused quite a sensation when they made recordings of the works of Hildegard von Bingen. Tell us a little bit about the group and how you got around to singing her works.
Yes, well, we started in 1986, a few years before we actually made a recording. And we were really fascinated by the close harmony sound of vocal music of the High Middle Ages, from England, from France, from Spain, that tightness of the way the harmony parts are written. And we explored both polyphony and chant at the beginning. And one natural thing that came to our minds would be the music of Hildegard, but we actually postponed singing her music because it's very, very challenging technically, and we wanted to really ripen our sound, our cohesiveness, and our blend before we got to that. And also, very important, we didn't want to be identified as a woman's music group. Even though we were four women, we wanted to just be a vocal ensemble that concentrated on medieval music. And also, from the beginning, we took on contemporary music as well. So we were doing both those things. So it was not until about seven years had gone by that we even attempted to sing Hildegard's music.
I think, though, what you did was you brought to light the music of an amazing woman. And again, you didn't want to be identified as a woman's group. But what you did was you really brought to the fore something that existed and something that musicologists, of course, would love and know about. But you brought it to the public, and that was an amazing thing to do, I think, certently in medieval music, which is a very specific type of music. It's really very scholarly, I would imagine, and confined to, I guess, the liturgical environment.
It's very interesting. You have to spend a lot of time in the library if you want to deal with the original sources and transcribe them and make sure you've got as your raw material is as close to the original source as possible. But it must not sound like the library, or nobody's going to want to listen to it. It's that that dual goal that we've always had in mind, to go and get the best research we possibly can, and then work on it like living music. And otherwise it's boring for us and it's boring for the audience. Bringing Hildegard to life for an equal voice group such as we are was really special, because we tried to imagine how her works would have been sung in their original context, and it probably would have been more than one person singing at a time. There are other groups that sing, and soloists who sing Hildegard beautifully and wonderfully, but it's that unity of intent, that cohesiveness that we try to get with all of us singing and with the same intention and musical intention and verbal intention, that I think set us apart a little bit from other ways of doing Hildegard.
In your newest album, this Four Centuries of Chant, you have that quality down pat, I think. It's not really one voice, but as you say, the quality is of one person singing, I think, the blending of it. It's unique. I think when you discuss this type of music, of course, it is it's very different, because you have to educate your public as well, in the sense that, oh, that's liturgical music, or that's what they sing in church. And you have to be, as I said, it's a scholarly endeavor, because a lot of people just don't. They'll listen and they'll say, oh, isn't that lovely, and isn't that unusual, and isn't that soothing? And there's that word again. But it's, as you describe it, it's music of that time. Isn't that what you're trying to say?
Yes, the difference between what we do with chant and what other groups do with chant is that we go back to the medieval sources and get actual chants from manuscripts as they would have been sung, say, in England or Spain or France or Germany or Eastern Europe. And we sing them from those manuscripts rather than some of the liturgical groups, like groups of monks who can sing extremely beautifully, but they're singing from the modern solemn books, which are amalgamations of early sources. So, you know, it's just some, it brings us a little closer to the past in our own spirit. And so in our program notes, we attempt to educate and say, this is where this is from and this is what it was used for. But people should be able to listen and just enjoy that, that unison line that we're creating, and all very much driven by the meaning and shape of the words. And it's very interesting that you say it sounds like one person singing, because my mom, when I gave her the record and she listened to it, she said, it's very nice, but you're the only one singing on the whole record.
Wow, that's a compliment.
It was a compliment. Well, of course, she's my mom and she'll hear my voice, but that's what we're trying to do. It's not just a vocal unison.
No,
it's a unity of intent and of the way we shape the lines.
Well, of course, you live this and you work with this, but in medieval times, when were chants sung, and where? I mean, where were they performed? Was it proper to not perform in public? I mean, you know, as entertainment, or that's what I'm trying to find out. Are these, by virtue of what they are, only to be sung within a religious setting?
Yes, they're for the most part, there might be a couple of exceptions. They're liturgical, which means part of the official worship service of the church. So they would have been sung in church, but there's various levels and flavors of church. There's a big diocesan cathedral, say like Notre Dame in Paris. Mm-hmm. And there's also little monasteries and convents where the monks or the nuns themselves would have done all the singing. And the public would have attended these liturgical services, or could have, and on big feast days would have. So as my husband, who's a church organist and music director, says, you know, liturgy is theater. And any priest or church musician will tell you the same thing. Liturgy is a form of theater where certain beliefs are really acted out in time in such a way as to inspire and bring together in a kind of a mystical communion all the worshipers. And the music is an essential part of this theater. So we're not a religious group, but we've culled out of the manuscripts some of the most beautiful and unusual chants from different parts of the liturgy, and put them together and put them in the programs from which these chants are drawn on the CD. They're usually in some sort of liturgical context, but we've never tried to recreate an actual liturgical service, but we just do a sort of context thing, and we mix them in with polyphony for the most part.
I was just going to say that's probably where there's variation. At least we'll have a little bit of harmony going on in there. What about contemporary music? I mean, you sing a cappella, of course. What about contemporary music?
Contemporary music has actually been a part of what we've been doing since almost the beginning. One of the first things we were hired to do was to sing incidental music to an ancient Greek play. I forget which one, but people were killing each other.
It was
somebody's tragedy. And a contemporary composer, Kim Sherman, wrote the incidental music, and we sang it a cappella. Voices of Light, Richard Einhorn's oratorio to be sung with The Passion of Joan of Arc, the great silent film, was, you know, from the mid-90s. And that's and then we've commissioned work by people like Steve Reich and Peter Maxwell Davies, John Tavener recording Darkness into Light. Mm-hmm. So it's always been there. Sometimes it's kind of medieval-esque sounding, and sometimes not. The piece that Peter Maxwell Davies wrote for us on that we performed on Welcome Yule makes your hair hurt. Extremely beautiful, but very thorny. So, you know, we, like a lot of groups, like the Hilliard Ensemble especially, comes to mind right away. We do, and Lionheart, the great New York male ensemble, we sort of go back and forth with that sort of thing, and very happy to do it.
Tell me what a lady mass is. I love the word.
Oh, yes. It's actually not a word that we made up. It's
No, I've heard it before, but I wondered what it was.
It's the It's a special votive or devotional mass for the Virgin Mary, which would have been usually said or sung on Saturdays in the Middle Ages, probably still now in some communities. Sunday was the Lord's Day, and Saturday was called Lady Day, and a day specially devoted to the Virgin Mary. And these Lady Masses, well, it's a special devotional mass. You'll find it in many chant manuscripts, segregated off by itself as a special devotional mass to be done on Saturday. And in great cathedrals, there'd usually be a lady chapel, which would be directly behind the main altar. If you walk up the nave to the main altar and then go around the back, usually behind a wall, there'll be a chapel to the Virgin Mary, and that would be where that would be said or chanted. And there are many devotional chants that in different places, they'd be different chants for the Lady Mass and different times of year. So we have the English Lady Mass, which is just a general composite Lady Mass with both chant and polyphony. And then we did a Lammas Lady Mass, which is for midsummer around the feast of the Virgin Mary's Assumption. So there's so much music. And people say, well, why do you sing so much music for the Virgin Mary? Do you, you know, what's the reason? And the answer is always because she got the best music.
Well,
it's just so true. Her cult was very, very strong in the High Middle Ages.
Yes.
And she did get the best music. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
We're speaking with Susan Hellauer, a member of the a cappella choral ensemble Anonymous Four. Now, how do you go from being a trumpet player to a vocalist?
Well, that was one of those funny little things that happened to all of us in life. I was a trumpet major at Queens College in New York, City University of New York, and I got Bell's palsy, and I could not play my trumpet.
Oh,
and
my.
I was required. Oh, my life was over. All I wanted to be was a trumpet player. That's all I could do and think about. And because it was a conservatory school, it still is. It's the Aaron Copland School of Music, where I now actually teach as an adjunct professor. I had to be in an ensemble, so they put me into the vocal ensemble in that particular semester. And most semesters, actually, they specialized in medieval and Renaissance music, a small vocal ensemble, because they knew I had a good ear and I'd figure it out. And I just – it was one of those pivotal moments. Paul Maynard was the director and consummate musician, and I just – my life turned on a dime right there. I had to take voice lessons because, you know, trumpet players don't sing because
singing is for sissies. But you know how to breathe. You know how to breathe. That's
yes.
One thing. So
I had very good trumpet instruction, so that was there, yeah.
Well, it's unusual. Well, I shouldn't say this. It betrays my what generation I'm in. But, you know, when you see women trumpet players, I mean, there always have been. And, you know, lots of times you start when you're in school and you're in the band and so on and so forth. But it's really rather it's not a jump, but it's rather interesting that you went from being an instrumentalist, of course, by necessity to singing and making what a glorious career you have made out of it. For our audience, please, define polyphony. It's harmony, of course, but how, in the sense, how would you describe it in the works that you do?
Yes. So chant, plain chant, with just one melody, we'll call that monophonic music, from the Greek one sound, monophonic. Mm-hmm. And when you start adding melody lines that sound well together, that's polyphonic, many sounds. And, you know, you can think of it most easily as, you know, when you learn to sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. And the melody, it's the same melody, but it starts at different times. So it's not so much harmony like guitar chords supporting a voice, but independent weaving melodies that weave together and work together. And that's the way most medieval music in more than one voice was composed and conceived of, not so much as being a melody being harmonized, but as a number of independent melodies that just happen to work well together.
It would be like a canon or a fugue if it's the same kind
yes.
of thing, yeah.
Yes, except it's not canonic, but it has that same nature
yes,
to it. Yes,
right,
absolutely.
Right. Well, this Four Centuries of Chant, you have no polyphony in this at all, do you?
I don't think there is. Yes, I was the one who picked out that those tracks. It's actually an anthology of our favorite chants from all of our CDs, because there are people who just love to listen to chant. We don't normally do a CD that's all chant. We'll always have some polyphonic music. But I believe that there isn't even a drone on
no,
this.
No, there's nothing.
It's all pure melody.
Where did you record that? You sound like you were in some kind of a wonderful small cathedral or something.
Actually, it's they're recorded in all different places. Since they're excerpts from our different recordings, there were a few. I don't know if the – I can't remember if the recording company actually, when they packaged it, said where each one was recorded. They might have, but it ranges from – I think one of them, the English Lady Mass excerpt, was done at Skywalker Ranch, the big sound studio out there. At Skywalker Ranch, and other things were done in a church, a Jesuit church up in Newton, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Other things out in California at a Christian Brothers retreat. One was definitely done in England in a beautiful 15th century chapel. So it's a really a tribute to Harmonia Mundi that they, I mean, they always do a great job, but that they managed to blend this all together. Brad Michael was the engineer, and he blended this all together to sound like it's from one place.
Well, now we can hear you live without any of the technical, I guess, magic that is done with the engineers. You're going to be presented by the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society on Friday, December 18th in concert. Is that right?
Yes, at St. Mark's Church, I believe it's just one of our favorite venues in the whole wide world. Beautiful church with lovely sound.
And what is your program going to be? Is this going to be Christmas-oriented? Or?
Yes, we're going to perform a program called The Cherry Tree, I believe, and that is going to be English carols with some interpolations of American songs that are related to that. And we call it the cherry tree because it sort of grows out of the story of Joseph and Mary and the cherry tree, mm-hmm. Where Joseph is angry at Mary because she's pregnant and not by him, and she asks for some cherries. He won't pick them for her because he's mad at her, but the cherry tree, the baby Jesus inside Mary, asks the cherry tree to bow down, and she gets the cherries, and Joseph is properly abashed and repentant. And it's a carol that really comes from the Middle Ages down into modern folk music as well.
So that will be on December 18th, I believe, at the church, St. Mark's Church.
Yes.
And and your newest, this album is your very newest, isn't it? The Four Centuries of Chant?
Yes, it's as I said, an anthology, but it's the latest release. We have other things in the pipeline, like The Cherry Tree, and also a new program we'll be premiering this fall called Secret Voices, Music from the Las Huelgas Codex, 13th century music for nuns who sang both chant and polyphony and had it written down for them. Very unusual and wonderful manuscript.
Now, you are a professor of music at Queens, is that right, Queens College?
Yes.
And you teach music history, and you also direct the Collegium Musicum? Is that right?
Yes.
Your work is, again, you do a lot of research, I would imagine, and you probably discover all kinds of wonderful, wonderful works that you didn't know before. Is that right?
That does happen, yes. Usually I know, because I have a degree in medieval musicology, I know what exists in manuscripts, at least generally, if not specifically. So I get an idea for a program, I go ferret out the music, and there are some pieces that I knew, and there's always pieces I didn't know and that are just, you know, maybe haven't been heard in hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's just such a privilege to bring them to life.
And you also play the guitar and banjo.
Yes.
Kind of.
Yes, I would not call myself a solo player on any of those things, but I love to sit in a Baroque orchestra and participate with the Baroque guitar, which I've done often, and be part of the continuo section.
Mm-hmm. Now, I love this chant camp. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's not an Anonymous Four enterprise. That's just my own thing, I'm really, really happy to have Anonymous Four joining me to do one of those out at Stanford this fall. It's just something I do to get people together and teach them about plain chant by a lot of singing. It's very active. It's very it's really a workshop where you just sing, 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 and learn without even realizing you're learning. And I do them all over the place. And it's people just, they love it. And I love it.
Yeah, it's always wonderful to bring new emotions to people. And singing, certainly, I think, will do that. Just one more question. You have really, you know, your group has been enormously successful. What do you think, what is the quality that distinguishes you, say, from other groups that have done, you know, also medieval music and so on? You've really been enormously successful. You've sold millions of albums.
I don't know. It's really hard to say because there's a lot of really good groups out there that do a lot of amazing work. And it's just, you know, sometimes I think it's just that people really latch on to a cappella singing, that, you know, that without any instrumental accompaniment, there's something very special about the human voice. We've been very lucky in how things went for us, that we were able to spend a lot of time practicing together. We rehearse a lot. And that, like, that unity of intent, mm-hmm. that line, that unison, I think, that blend and the unison that comes from all that work, because we all sound so different from each other, that work, I think, comes through. And you know what? It is more than anything else, that we're really in love with every piece we sing. And that's not just empty words. We really are in love with every song we sing. Maybe that comes through.
That comes through. And people are in love with what you sing. So it's been a pleasure, Susan, speaking with you. And we look forward to your concert, The Anonymous Four, performing with the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society on December 18th. And we also look forward to all of your newest releases. Thanks again.
Thanks. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Same here.